parents. If you've never heard it, I want to introduce you to your new favorite song.
Just close. thought I'd see the day I had to say goodbye. Daddy, please don't go. I can't do this on my own. There's no way that I can walk this road alone. Daddy grabbed my hand and said, just 'cause I'm leaving, it don't mean it.
Listening to America's positively encouraging music, 98.3. This is Radio Health Journal, a weekly news magazine with the latest in health, medicine, and technology. I'm Shel Lustig.
I'm Nancy Benson.
And I'm Elizabeth Westfield. This week, the deadly difference between sickle cell trait and sickle cell disease.
So it's a really interesting evolutionary phenomenon. It's like one copy of the gene is protective and two copies are fatal.
Then why hasn't evolution protected us from all diseases?
So evolution is trying to do the best that it can within some really strong constraints.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
I can't wait for what's next. Even with higher stroke risk due to atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem, Eliquis, apixaban tablets, reduces stroke risk. It's the number one cardiologist prescribed blood thinner.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without talking to your doctor, as this may increase your risk of stroke. Eliquis can cause serious and in rare cases fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or have antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding or unusual bruising, or if you have tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. It may increase your bleeding risk if you take medicines such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
Malaria is a serious disease that's passed to humans through mosquitoes. The CDC reports that 627,000 people died from the illness in 2020, and most of those cases were children in sub-Saharan Africa. While it impacts populations around the world, Dr. Russell Ware, a pediatric hematologist, says it's a big issue in Africa, India, and Southeast Asia.
Because it's such a killer, any DNA mutation that might have occurred that could allow you to survive malaria would continue and would be propagated. And so sickle cell trait is actually a mutation that occurred in multiple locations that confers a survival advantage against malaria. So sickle cell trait is a good thing to have if you live in sub-Saharan Africa. So that's why trait is so common there, because it's a good thing to have. It allows you to survive.
However, serious issues arise when two people who both have the sickle cell trait create a baby. There's a 25% chance that their child will end up having sickle cell disease.
So it's a really interesting evolutionary phenomenon. It's like one copy of the gene is protective and two copies are fatal.
Ware is the director of hematology at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center and specializes in sickle cell disease. This umbrella term includes sickle cell anemia, which is an inherited chronic blood disorder that can result in death if left untreated.
So sickle cell anemia is probably the worst disease that most people don't know about, because it's an inherited genetic blood disorder that causes a lot of morbidity, pain, early mortality for Americans, particularly African Americans.
The CDC reports that one out of every 365 African Americans are born with the condition. But even with 100,000 Americans being diagnosed, Ware says it's still a neglected disease. Dr. Grace Onimo, a pediatric hematologist-oncologist, is hoping to change this pattern through her work with the American Sickle Cell Association. She says the first step is spreading awareness of the condition.
It's one of the most common genetic diseases that we have here in the United States. And what happens is in this disorder, there is a mutation in the genes that govern the red cells, so that instead of the red cells that are being produced having a nice round shape, they tend to have a crescent shape, like a half moon. And this interferes with the activity and function.
Healthy red blood cells are round and contain hemoglobin, which is a protein that carries oxygen to the rest of the body. But people with sickle cell have abnormal hemoglobin, which makes the cells form into a crescent shape that's hard and sticky. This change causes them to get stuck and clog blood flow, resulting in infections, pain, and heart issues. The sickle cells also die much earlier than healthy ones, causing a constant shortage of red blood cells. Onimo specializes in sickle cell disease because of her personal experience growing up in Nigeria.
I immigrated to the States from a country that has the highest rate of sickle cell disease. So I saw it in my family, friends, you know, colleagues. It wasn't a mysterious disorder for me.
So when she landed in Cleveland, Ohio, Onimo jumped at the chance to work with the American Sickle Cell Association.
So the American Sickle Cell Association is a Cleveland-based organization, and it has been in existence for at least half a century. So they have been here for a very long time. And their function is to provide a wide range of medical, social work-oriented services to individuals and families who have been diagnosed with either the sickle cell disease or the sickle cell trait. So they're going to provide confirmatory testing for sickle cell and other red cell-related disorders. They're going to provide counseling to the affected patients and families and caregivers. They are going to follow this patient for life.
Since it's a chronic disorder, patients will battle with sickle cell disease their entire life. The only known cure at the moment is a bone marrow transplant, but Ware says these procedures are rare. Instead, the illness is manageable with daily medication, just like for someone who has high blood pressure or diabetes. Up until recently, the only drug that was used is called hydroxyurea.
It was identified almost 40 years ago, and it's an incredibly powerful, potent medicine to treat the symptoms and signs of sickle cell anemia. And it does it in a way that wasn't really predicted. It actually boosts a kind of blood element called fetal hemoglobin, and it reverts back to the way we make our blood when we're infants. And this protects blood against sickling. So it's a very powerful drug. It's very easy to take. It's an oral medicine. So you swallow the capsules once a day and you go on about your business. So it has a lot of attraction as a treatment, a therapeutic treatment for sickle cell.
But sickle cell wasn't the first application for hydroxyurea. It was discovered more than 100 years ago and was initially used as a chemotherapy drug for leukemia. Scientists then realized its benefits in treating HIV before eventually getting hydroxyurea FDA approved for sickle cell.
It was used at different doses. So don't think of it as hydroxyurea for sickle cell patients as chemotherapy. That's a big mistake that sometimes is made. We're not using it the same way. We're not using it for the same effect at all. So we don't want to call it an anti-HIV medicine. We don't want to call it a cancer treatment. We want to call it a sickle cell treatment.
The dose that's used to treat sickle cell is taken once a day for many years. Ware says that there's almost no side effects to hydroxyurea when it's used to treat this disease.
I've been treating some patients for well over 20 years with hydroxyurea. And the good news is it works just as well after 20 years as it did at the beginning. And it works just as well for infants and children as it does for adults, maybe even better. It's almost like taking a vitamin. You just gotta take it and go about your business. So it's more about remembering it. There's very few side effects associated with the dose itself.
Which is wonderful because for decades, it was the only option. A few new medications have been approved since 2017, giving patients and medical providers more choices for treatment. But just like with many other chronic diseases, treatments can be expensive. Ware and his colleagues recently published a study in pharmacoeconomics that looks at the cost effectiveness of treating low-income patients with hydroxyurea. They set the study in the East African country of Uganda and reviewed the difference of patients taking a smaller and therefore cheaper dose of medication, the ideal dose that requires more blood tests or no treatment at all.
Is it worth doing it? What if you have to do extra blood tests to get that better dose? What's the cost effectiveness of dose escalation in a poor country? And the answer there was clear too, that it was much more cost effective to increase the dose, because any expense you had by taking a little more medicine or having a blood count done more frequently was more than offset by not being in the hospital.
Ware says these results also translate to patients in America.
Every study that's been done in the U.S. that's looked at hospital charges and other things very much show that it's cost effective to be on hydroxyurea versus nothing at all. So sickle cell patients, if they're untreated, this is like the kinds of patients that I took care of when I started my medical training, when there was no medicine and you didn't know if they were going to come in with a pain crisis next week, or they might have a pneumonia and get really sick from that. They could have a stroke and come in as their first presentation. So children and adults with sickle cell who are not treated are not protected from any of the clinical events that happen.
The good news is that Ware says using hydroxyurea as a treatment for sickle cell doesn't often cause a substantial amount of financial stress.
Because the drug was first identified to have clinical activity back in the 1960s, no company owns a patent on it and nobody has any ability to control the price. So each capsule of hydroxyurea is about 50 cents, which in pharmaceuticals is nothing, right? So you can treat a patient all year long and do multiple blood tests for probably $1,000. Now, the new medicines that are coming out are more like $100,000 a year. And so there, the cost-benefit ratio is more of a question. But a preventive medicine like hydroxyurea is very cheap.
Now in America, every baby is tested for sickle cell disease as a part of regular newborn screenings. Ware says hydroxyurea is the standard of care for kids at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, even if they haven't yet developed any symptoms from the disease.
This is a philosophical shift too. It used to be that we would wait until they start to have pain, pneumonia, sickle cell problems, and then say, okay, let's put you on medicine. But then we've evolved over the last 10 years to say we can prevent these problems. We should start the babies when they're 6, 12 months of age before they develop sickle cell complications. And that's what we do at Cincinnati Children's. So all of our children, all of our babies and toddlers are on hydroxyurea and they stay on that. And most of them do so well that they don't have to consider adding a second medicine on. But in our opinion, every patient should be on hydroxyurea as the standard of care and optimize the dose. And then if they still need something, you could consider a second medicine.
Unfortunately, these treatments only work if the patients and parents of patients understand how serious this disease is.
I always say education is power. I have seen patients get educated and that's changed the entire scope of the disease for them. Because for one, they gained understanding into what or how disease was affecting their bodies and their daily function. They were able to understand the changes they needed to make in their daily routine, be it taking their medications, be it coming for treatment, scheduled treatments in the hospital, you know, to change the entire course of the disease.
Which is why the American Sickle Cell Association can be such a great resource for patients and families. And while it's currently a lifelong disease for most patients, Ware says that the advancements in gene editing technology may let us eventually be able to correct this genetic disease before the baby is even born. You can find more information about Dr. Russell Ware, Dr. Grace Animo, and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
Coming up, is the success of humanity based on luck? When Radio Health Journal returns.
Join Macy's and our nonprofit partners to help address the youth mental health crisis this school year. Now through September 14th, you can fund mental health services and resources when you donate online to the Jed Foundation and the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Or round up your Macy's store purchase up to 99 cents and donate the extra change. Give back today and learn more about our mission to create brighter futures for all at Macy's.com/purpose.
Happy 62nd birthday, Granddad.
Thanks, sweetheart.
I got you this.
A mug. Oh, thank you. What does it say? Beware. If you are 60 or older, you may be at increased risk of hospitalization from RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, compared to adults younger than 60.
Not all dangers come with warning labels. Talk to your pharmacist or doctor about getting vaccinated against RSV today. Learn more at bewareofrsv.com. Brought to you by Pfizer.
Last week, we explained how evolution protected populations based on their environment. Today, we're once again joined by Dr. Tony Capra, an associate professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of California in San Francisco. He's breaking down how our ancestry is shaping the future of medicine, starting with the history of disease. To say that disease is a product of human evolution is correct, but may not give disease its due credit. In fact, the basis of genetic disease was created before humanity. And even after the rise of humans, we only became vulnerable to disease because certain evolutionary changes created an opening for infection.
Our bodies are the result of really hundreds of millions of years of evolution. And so those systems and the relationships between them have been set up and evolved over hundreds of millions of years. And as we have adapted some of those systems, for example, our big fat heads and our upright walking, that's put certain strains on that body plan that, you know, lead to kind of unique human potential for disease.
For example, Capra says that the changes required of a female body to carry a pregnancy and give birth have led to a higher risk of certain conditions.
It's a very, very delicate balance that, you know, humans have walked, and it still leads to many, many challenges and, you know, dangers of pregnancy. That's just one example where human-specific biology created this potential for new diseases that are less common or not present at all in other lineages. But, you know, there are tons of examples like this where we have evolved and adapted, or even not adapted, but just evolved our way to certain traits that lead to or that expose weaknesses in our general body plan or in our physiology.
And that's not only a human issue. The challenge of evolution has always been trying to find ways to protect us from the environment while working within the constraints of our physical bodies. Since this process has affected our genes over hundreds of thousands of years, Capra argues that we need to factor it in when tailoring a medical treatment to patients today.
Anything that involves taking someone's genome and trying to better understand their risk for disease or response to a specific treatment really has to consider evolution. Because when we interpret a genome, we are explicitly looking at, I think, as I said before, this is an evolutionary document. This is something that was shaped explicitly by the evolutionary process over the last, you know, several thousand years of our species in the sort of most specific way. And so that's one place. If we're looking at genomes, we have to think about the ancestry and origins and interactions of the different pieces of the genome that a given individual carries.
Though you may not expect it, the same gene can act differently from one person to another, which is why genomic precision medicine must include the evolutionary perspective, because this context is crucial to how the gene is expressed in each person.
So, for example, like if we look at many rare diseases that are caused by, you know, a single mutation, often it turns out that if we look in diverse populations, we'll find people that have that variant that we think that causes the disease, but they're perfectly fine. And so this is an effect called variable penetrance, where basically the effect of that one genetic variant in one population may lead to a really severe disease. But another population, because they have other compensatory changes in their genome, it may not.
Capra says this perspective is needed at all stages of research, not just the ending treatment plan. In order for us to get a true understanding of how a drug or procedure might affect humans, our animal studies need to mimic us as close as possible.
We really need to understand how the physiology of the mouse is similar and different to us. And in some ways, mice are very, very, very much like us and great models for studying treatments in humans. In other situations, for example, like pregnancy and reproductive traits, they're incredibly different from the way that gestation proceeds, from the way that they signal to their bodies that they are pregnant and then that it is time to deliver. So like just we would have a really hard time generalizing and testing treatments that we propose in human systems in a mouse system. And actually, if you think about the evolutionary history and the life history of different species, that would lead you to certain other organisms that are better models for that trait.
After applying this evolutionary perspective, Capra says the next step is to specifically identify a person's race and ancestry, something he believes the medical field is only now starting to figure out.
What exactly does it mean to be Black or white or Hispanic? What, you know, these are terms that are not really rooted in biology. But there is also then this concept of ancestry that is where different individuals have inherited parts of their genome from individuals that lived in different parts of the world with different environments, different challenges. And those do shape the way that a given genetic variant or a given drug treatment may affect that individual.
Meaning that it's not enough to look at a person's skin color and make a judgment call. By really getting into a person's ancestry, we can help personalize treatments to their specific needs. It will also help physicians understand which medications won't work as well based on their genetics. Capra says there's been a growing appreciation for this perspective, but we're still not where we need to be if the goal is truly personalized medical care.
Evolution explains so much of why we are the way we are and why our bodies make certain trade-offs in terms of, you know, committing certain resources at one time to growing versus committing resources at another time to maintenance, to, you know, why we age and when we age. All of these very basic essential factors of our bodies and how they grow and develop were shaped by this evolutionary history. And so I think there's great potential for using an understanding of like what those evolutionary challenges and trade-offs that our ancestors faced were, in terms of thinking about where can we intervene, what might be side effects if we do intervene in a given system. And that's something that I think is really just at the beginning stages.
So as the field of genomics grows and DNA sequencing becomes more common, Capra believes this evolutionary perspective will help us understand the effects of the genetic variants we discover.
Almost all of the genetic differences that are present in modern human populations. So like if we compared ourselves to one another and looked at all the places that differ, we could trace the history of those specific genetic variants back in time, but they're all actually really recent in evolutionary terms.
You can find more information about Dr. Tony Capra and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our production manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Nancy Benson. Radio Health Journal returns in just a moment.
New research from the San Diego State University shows that daily strawberry consumption may be linked to improved cognitive function, lower blood pressure, and higher antioxidant capacity in older adults. The randomized clinical trial presented at Nutrition 2023, an annual meeting of the American Society of Nutrition, built on previous research demonstrating the cardiovascular, metabolic, and cognitive health benefits of strawberries. Sharon Hushmand, professor in the School of Exercise and Nutrition Sciences at San Diego State University, was the principal investigator on the study and added that she was encouraged that a simple dietary change like adding strawberries to the daily diet may promote cognitive function and improve cardiovascular risk factors such as hypertension in older adults. In addition to providing 100% of our daily vitamin C needs, strawberries contain heart-healthy nutrients like folate, potassium, fiber, phytosterols, and polyphenols. For more information on the health benefits of strawberries, visit californiastrawberries.com.
I can't wait for what's next. Even with higher stroke risk due to atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem, Eliquis, apixaban tablets, reduces stroke risk. It's the number one cardiologist-prescribed blood thinner.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without talking to your doctor, as this may increase your risk of stroke. Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or have antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding or unusual bruising, or if you have tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. It may increase your bleeding risk if you take medicines such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
Medical notes this week. Are tick bites messing up your diet? New data from the CDC shows that it's much more common than previously thought. As many as 450,000 people may have contracted alpha-gal syndrome from Lone Star ticks between 2010 and 2022. The disease causes an allergic reaction in people when eating red meat like beef, pork, or lamb. This tick is common in the eastern and southern parts of the U.S., and there's no cure or treatment yet for the syndrome. New technology can detect COVID-19 in just seconds. Researchers have developed a breath test that users simply blow into, then wait for quick results. Unlike nasal swabs and current at-home tests that take up to 15 minutes, the results for this device appear in less than a minute. Researchers think this rapid testing will be most useful in hospitals and other facilities where people live in close quarters, like nursing homes and college dorms. The work is published in Nature Communications. Is your child a picky eater or the victim of a chronic disease? Eosinophilic esophagitis is a serious disease that's more common in children than adults. It makes swallowing difficult and is caused by food allergies or airborne allergens. Fortunately, new research published in Nature Communications Biology suggests that blocking a pro-inflammatory immune system response is an effective treatment for children with this condition. And finally, do you really need an antibiotic? Antibiotic resistance is a growing problem, so using them only when absolutely necessary is the best option. A study published in JAMA found that 5 million children are prescribed antibiotics each year for sinusitis, a common sinus infection, but only about half of those prescribed see improvements. The researchers say many of these cases may be misdiagnosed and suggest that a nasal swab for bacteria could help reduce the number of unnecessary antibiotic prescriptions. And that's Medical Notes this week. I'm Shel Lustig.
Join Macy's and our nonprofit partners to help address the youth mental health crisis this school year. Now through September 14th, you can fund mental health services and resources when you donate online to the Jed Foundation and the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Or round up your Macy's store purchase up to 99 cents and donate the extra change. Give back today and learn more about our mission to create brighter futures for all at Macy's.com/purpose.
Research shows people ignore radio ads. While I want you to remember that Liberty Mutual customizes and saves you hundreds on home insurance, I know no one's listening, so I can say anything. I can even tell Jenny that I never stop thinking about us. Sometimes I almost call, but I only truly feel safe revealing this in the privacy of my nationally broadcast radio ad.
Only pay for what you need at libertymutual.com. Savings may vary, underwritten by Liberty Mutual Insurance Company and affiliates, excludes Massachusetts.
Liberty, 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 liberty.
And that's Radio Health Journal for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more. And check Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify for a library of past programs. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and information about our guests at radiohealthjournal.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.
This week on Viewpoints.
Our kids today are getting messages from the media, from their peers' parents, teachers, coaches, to achieve, to achieve, to achieve.
With so much pressure, when is there time to enjoy being young? Then
the problem is not with the technology, but the planning for end of life. And one of the challenges that we see is 90% of end of life panels end up in the landfill.
America's growing solar panel problem. I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
Join Macy's and our nonprofit partners to help address the youth mental health crisis this school year. Now through September 14th, you can fund mental health services and resources when you donate online to the Jed Foundation and the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Or round up your Macy's store purchase up to 99 cents and donate the extra change. Give back today and learn more about our mission to create brighter futures for all at Macy's.com/purpose.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
AutoZone is more than a parts store. It's where we help you solve problems like,
sorry I'm late, my battery died.
And,
I need a jump, again.
At America's number one battery destination, you can find the right battery at the right price with options starting at only $89.99. And we offer free battery testing and charging whenever you need it. Get the parts and help you need to get the job done right at AutoZone.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
It's not uncommon for students to feel a sense of dread or anxiety once summer's over and school is back in session. However, for some, these emotions are a constant and can be indicative of a larger problem. One big issue is the extreme level of pressure adolescents face these days. Whether it's school, sports, or hobbies, there's an endless push to come out on top. One expert chiming in on this epidemic is Jennifer Bruhenny-Wallace, a journalist and contributor to The Wall Street Journal and The Washington Post. She's also the author of Never Enough, When Achievement Culture Becomes Toxic and What We Can Do About It.
Children and the adults in their lives have come to look at achievement as either a lack of achievement as an indictment against their worth or achievement as their worth. And that's when it becomes toxic, when our worth is tied and tangled up in our achievements. And that's happening with too many kids today. And it's leading to a rise of anxiety, depression, and suicide ideation among our youth. And the Surgeon General has pointed that out. It's that never enough feeling.
Wallace says that she's not anti-achievement or anti-ambition, but it's important for young people as well as adults to separate self-worth from performance. She adds that this isn't an easy thing to do, especially in modern society where competition is fierce.
In the 1970s, when I was growing up, life was generally more affordable. You could afford housing, real estate was more affordable, higher education was more affordable, healthcare was more affordable, food was more affordable, everything was more affordable. So a parent could be a bit more relaxed in their parenting and still believe that their child would do okay with some setbacks and mistakes and failures. But in the last few years, we have seen a huge shift. We are in the midst of some of the greatest inequality we've ever experienced as a country. There's been the crush of the middle class, globalization, hyper-competition, and parents are becoming, in the words of researchers, social conduits, absorbing these macroeconomic pressures, and it's coming out in how we parent. And this is not to blame parents. This is not parents' fault. Our job as parents is to raise kids who will survive and thrive in adulthood when we are no longer around.
As Wallace said, parents are not solely to blame. This culture is ingrained into society, while wellness is often pushed aside. A packed school and study schedule means little time to de-stress, relax, and get enough sleep. On average, teens need between 8 and 10 hours of shut-eye per night. But a recent poll by the National Sleep Foundation found that 70% of high school students aren't reaching this on school nights. These challenges make things harder for students across the board. And for those at a top private school or in an accelerated program, the pressure can feel inescapable.
In 2019, I wrote an article for the Washington Post reporting that two national policy reports were now naming kids in what researchers call high-achieving schools. Those are competitive public and private schools around the country, that those kids were now officially an at-risk group. After kids in poverty, after kids with incarcerated parents, recent immigrants, and children in foster care, these students attending these competitive schools are now at risk for 2 to 6 times the clinical rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide ideation found in these communities compared to the average American teen. And so, you know, these kids who are given all of these opportunities, it was really startling as both a parent and a researcher to see that these kids were now officially at risk.
Wallace reminds us that there's a healthy balance between encouraging adolescence versus promoting toxic achievement culture. She recommends looking inwards and asking these four important questions.
One is to look at your child's calendar. See how they're spending their time outside of school. Then look at where, as a parent, you spend your money as it relates to your child. Is a lot of the money spent in resume enriching activities? Third is, what do you ask your child about? When they come home from school, what are the conversations that you're asking them about? And the fourth thing is, what do you argue with your child about?
You can also apply the same logic to yourself by modifying these questions. Do you tend to connect your own self-worth with how you perform? What are some of the internal negative dialogues that run through your head on a given day? Wallace believes it's important to consider these aspects as well.
One of the biggest takeaways of the book is that the number one intervention for any child in distress is to make sure that the primary caregiver, most often the mother or the father, that the primary caregiver's resilience and well-being and mental health is intact, because a child's resilience rests fundamentally on their caregiver's resilience. And we can't be the first responders to our kids' struggles if we are not filled ourselves.
At the end of the day, there's more to life than making the honor roll or a varsity team. However, it's much harder to shake this feeling of failure as a young person. For parents listening, Wallace says it's vital to keep an open dialogue with your children. Keep reinforcing the personal value they add instead of focusing on accomplishments. If you have time, you can also get involved with their school by attending a school board meeting. This is a great setting to start a conversation on how the administration can better support students.
What are the values that are being signaled to the kids? Are all of the students that attend your school, do they all feel like they matter? Do they all feel valued? Or do only certain kids get the message that they're valued? Those who make the honor roll, those who make the A team. There are organizations around the country that go into schools and give them mental health well-being report cards. That's a first step in finding out what your students' mental health is like. So Challenge Success is one nonprofit, Authentic Connections is another, and they will go in there with these really useful, scientifically backed surveys to see the stressors and to point educators to ways where they can start buffering against excessive pressure.
To find links and resources to the organizations mentioned and find out more about Jennifer Bruhenny Wallace, visit viewpointsradio.org. For more behind the scenes, check out Viewpoints Radio on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. This segment was written and produced by Grace Galante. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price.
Coming up, keeping toxins from millions of end-of-life solar panels out of America's landfills when Viewpoints returns.
Some days I cover up because of my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. Now I'm hitting the road with clearer skin thanks to Skyrizi, Risankizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150 milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. Nothing is everything. With Skyrizi, 3 out of 4 people achieved 90% clearer skin at 4 months. And Skyrizi is just 4 doses a year after 2 starter doses.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin, and that means everything. Your doctor today about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist prescribed biologic in psoriasis, and visit skyrizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
Research shows people ignore radio ads. While I want you to remember that Liberty Mutual customizes and saves you hundreds on home insurance, I know no one's listening, so I can say anything. I can even tell Jenny that I never stop thinking about us. Sometimes I almost call, but I
only truly feel safe revealing this in the privacy of my nationally broadcast radio ad.
Only pay for what you need at libertymutual.com. Savings may vary, underwritten by Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. Affiliates excludes Massachusetts.
Liberty, 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 liberty.
If this were a Reese's TV ad, you'd be staring at a Reese's peanut butter cup. And sure, my voice is peanut buttery smooth, but still, you need to see the peanut butter cups, right? No? I can really just say Reese's and you'll go get some? Okay. Reese's. 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 Really working, actually. Reese's. Reese's. This, I'm onto something. Reese's. Reese's. Reese's.
If you did any long-distance driving this summer, you probably passed dozens of corn and soybean fields. But you may have also seen quite a few solar farms. From a distance, it looks like endless rows of hundreds of jet-black panels aimed at the sky. According to the Department of Energy, solar power is the fastest-growing source of electricity in the U.S. It emits no carbon into the atmosphere, and many experts say it's safer than nuclear power. Across the country today, there are about 500 million photovoltaic, or PV, panels up and running. At an annual growth rate of 21%, you can expect to see even more solar farms filling rural landscapes as well as on rooftops of residential homes around your neighborhood. However, there's one problem that manufacturers and policymakers are just beginning to address. Once these panels are deemed unusable, they more often than not end up in landfills, where they end up spewing toxic waste that's harmful to humans.
Typically, in the past, it was left for the installer, the developer, O&M folks to figure a way to discard these. And often, you know, there was some secondary market practices that were being done. They were being donated. They were being resold to other markets. But often, you would find that the broken, unusable modules will end up in landfills.
That's Adam Sagai, the chief executive officer of We Recycle Solar, a firm that provides solar panel recycling solutions and helps people meet environmental compliance concerns. Sagai points out that there's still no federal law prohibiting the dumping of used or damaged panels. This has led to about 90% of unusable panels ending up in landfills.
The problem is so large. This is a tsunami. It's a wave of end-of-life products that's hitting the market so quickly and so fast.
He points out that when new cell phones, laptops, and in this case, solar panels are developed, manufacturers are focused on creating a great product and getting it out to consumers as quickly as possible. What often gets pushed aside is what happens to the product after its shelf life.
Now, I will say that is changing. Obviously, we're now working with some folks that are in the manufacturing space, and they are designing for end of life. The older technology obviously has a lot of contaminants, has a lot of different elements in it that do require them to be handled and processed properly.
To that end, businesses like We Recycle Solar and others are collecting these damaged solar panels and recycling them.
Typically, you have some of this material that has cadmium and lead in the construction of the panel, but if treated the proper way, it's not a problem. It's when it goes into the landfill that it may leach into the water supply and the soil, which creates the problems that we are trying to avoid.
Experts say the lifespan of older generation PV panels is about 20 years, while newer models can last 30 to 35 years. Most of the 500 million panels now in use were installed after 2016, so they still have plenty of life in them. By the time they need to be retired, experts say many more recycling options will be in place. But Sagai argues that there needs to be an intentional push to build out this industry. Currently, there are only about a dozen large-scale recycling companies in the U.S. that are equipped to handle PV panels. One expert chiming in on the barriers to this growth is Jesse Simons. He's the co-founder and chief commercial officer of another solar recycling company called SolarCycle. According to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, recycling costs $15 to $45 per module, whereas landfilling costs only $1 to $5 per module.
The good news is that we are seeing significant
voluntary leadership from the industry stepping forward and recycling, because they know that it makes sense. They know that it's critical as a way to build community support for their projects.
Simons believes that another big downside to trashing end-of-life solar panels is the misuse of valuable resources like silver, silicon, aluminum, and more.
Companies like ours are now on the scene and have found a way to extract significant value from those panels, getting out the silver and the silicon, the aluminum and the copper. And in doing so, we're making it have economic sense to recycle rather than landfill. I do think that more panels are being landfilled than they should be right now, but we are rapidly changing that through innovation and scale. In fact, we've studied this ourselves and determined that you can turn one old solar panel into 1.5 new solar panels with all the materials that are in the old ones.
Residential solar panels make up 20% of the market. Simons believes that when the first generation of residential PV panels needs to be replaced 12 to 15 years from now, the industry will have reached what he calls landfill parity. In other words, the cost of recycling will be much cheaper than it is today. He says it may cost the same as landfilling or less.
Finding solutions for end of life and for recycling that work for the large businesses that own that solar should be our first priority. That's not to say we shouldn't find solutions for the individual homeowner has solar or needs to recycle, but that'll be relatively easy to figure out if we can come up with solutions that scale for the place where most of that solar is owned, which is the large solar farms and the utilities and others.
Manufacturers are also thinking ahead now and making today's newer generation of solar panels more recycle friendly.
We're seeing panels made with a lot less lead. Some are completely lead free. That just makes it significantly easier to recycle at the end of life because they have no hazardous components. And we're seeing a lot of improvements in that direction.
Simon says it's likely that most communities across the country don't yet have policies in place regarding the disposal of solar panels. Our call to a local landfill proved this to be true. Simons encourages municipalities to consult with SolarCycle or other recyclers in their area so they can create an interconnected framework.
Solutions like the one we put in place with Green Tech Renewables, where a customer can simply drop off the panels, and once you fill up a container full, we will take them at a very low price and recycle them and return them back into the supply chain. So I think that's the solution. What we don't want is a bunch of different counties or municipalities setting up individual patchwork of regulations that ultimately make it really difficult to manage how we do recycling or how we deploy solar. It'd be much better if this were a harmonized set of policies.
The Solar Energy Industries Association, a big nonprofit in the sector, is aiming for solar energy to make up roughly 30% of all generated electricity in America by the year 2030.
I see solar as the fastest growing source of energy. It is clean, it's reliable, it's cheap, it's good for the climate, it's good for the air, it creates jobs. And the recycling side of it, while this hasn't been a major priority for the industry until recently, now that people are really focusing on it, now that we're going to take our attention and turn it to recycling in the same way we did to building panels cheaply and reliably in the first place, I think we're going to ultimately get to a place where we're going to be able to endlessly recycle the solar panels once they're built into new solar panels in the future.
You can find out more about solar energy and how to recycle end-of-life solar panels from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory's website at nrel.gov or by visiting our website at viewpointsradio.org. You'll also learn more about our guests, Adam Sagai and Jesse Simons, as well as all of our past guests. This segment was written and produced by Polly Hansen. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
I can't wait for what's next. Even with higher stroke risk due to atrial fibrillation, an irregular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem, Eliquis, apixaban tablets, reduces stroke risk. It's the number one cardiologist-prescribed blood thinner. Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without talking to your doctor, as this may increase your risk of stroke.
Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or have antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding or unusual bruising, or if you have tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. It may increase your bleeding risk if you take medicines such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
This is Viewpoints Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. When's the last time you rode a train? I'll bet it's been a while. From New York to LA, many major metropolitan cities have been feeling the pinch. For a long time, local commuter trains relied on workers who needed to get back and forth between home and the office. But the COVID-19 pandemic shook up that steady flow of income. Even today, the way many people work is different. The norm of being in person 9 to 5, 5 days a week is no more for millions of white-collar employees. In San Francisco, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, known as BART, hasn't regained even half of the ridership that it had pre-pandemic, according to the American Public Transportation Association. In Chicago, the local commuter train company, Metra, is also struggling to regain its riders. Metra reported that average weekday ridership this past June was about 148,000. Go back to June 2019, and this number was 288,000. So what are companies doing to bounce back? For one, they're focusing more on non-commuters. These are single riders or families who are taking the train to go to the zoo, a concert, or spend a Saturday out in the city. This means shifting train times around and investing in new infrastructure that creates new passenger stops along the way. It's a big gamble, but one that's needed. Only time will tell if rail prevails. That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine what's new and old in entertainment. Some people seem to think comedy is dying, especially the era of goofball box office smashes, like The Hangover or just about any Will Ferrell movie. Some comics, most notably the famed stand-up Dave Chappelle, blame the rise of so-called cancel culture, arguing tiredly that you just can't make jokes like you used to without offending anyone. But if you look closer, I'd say that comedy is really everywhere, and it may be funnier than ever before. Comedy used to more or less exist within its delegated spaces, spaces where it was okay to be funny, where it was encouraged to laugh. In the physical sense, this meant comedy clubs, open mic nights, and improv theaters. In the ephemeral world of TV and film, sitcoms like Seinfeld, sketch shows like Saturday Night Live, improv shows like Whose Line Is It Anyway?, any late-night talk show, and of course, those laugh-out-loud movies I mentioned before. But now, humor seems to be ingrained in almost every piece of entertainment we consume, and the lines between what's comedy and what's not are further blurred. Was the popular 2017 film Get Out a comedy? Its creator Jordan Peele is certainly known for being incredibly funny, and the movie may have had elements of dark comedy, but there's nothing outright funny about its premise. What about Barry, the hit series created by and starring former SNL cast member Bill Hader? Or The Bear,